This morning we are going to talk about what you do if you have a kind of inkling that the life of your own congregation can be deepened and enriched and be more faithful if you begin to move toward a more covenantal relationship. And I want to just talk a little in the beginning about what happened in our congregation. It doesn't say anything about what can happen in your congregation, but it gives you a kind of picture of how we went through it. We started with one person, that was myself, who had read a little bit, been in Holden a lot, wanted to take Holden back to the city, wanted to embody it in the life of some community. And I went to my minister. There are two essential things, I think. One is one person, and the other is the minister. If you don't have the minister on your side, I just think you might as well. You're never going to create it within the life of the congregation, I think. You may, but I think it's very dubious, at least. And fortunately, I had a minister who was very sympathetic, very interested, lived in a collective, that is, he lived with seven people where they lived in one big home and made it possible for them to have this home, to have gracious living and eating their meals together, just a delightful place to be, so that he was sympathetic. And then we started with informal sessions. We invited people that we knew might be interested just to come and talk about what their needs were in the way of more interrelatedness. Mothers with away from their families, away from their blood families, in the city for a university for 4 or 5 years, feeling really isolated. And we just talked informally, and we had a couple of sessions like that. And there actually were our family and another family that somehow had begun to think that this was a good way. And Sarah bought into that largely, I think, because this was our extended family already. And so it made some sense. So we had those informal discussions. And I think that whoever is leading them needs to, read something like, and I brought some of these along and purchased them here for $2.95. I don't get any commission. I don't. But I think this is a good kind of thing to stimulate you to see what another group has done. And there's several others. Actually, we had participated up here in the discussion of the Joyful Community, Benjamin Zablocki's book, The Joyful Community, in one of the book sessions. And Paul Hain and I, the Haines and the Pitchers, had kind of agreed we were going to do this thing. And Paul is now doing it in Seattle in his way, which is to start a community somewhat like yours, to start it. And I went in the congregation to start it. Another thing you could do, of course, is join an already going community. But my idea is to try to figure out what can be done within the context of a congregation, since if it doesn't fit congregational life in the long run, it won't be meaningful. You know, somehow if it doesn't really speak to what a congregation can do and work at, I don't think it'll be very meaningful. If it does, then you see you've got the framework for all kinds of possibilities. So some reading. I had some personal conversations with a few people, and I located two people that were really interested in this kind of thing, Julie and Roy. So we started with three and decided to have some discussion. And we took Elizabeth O'Connor's The New Community, which is a book describing some of the life of the Church of the Savior in Washington, which has always been a church which attracted me. There are other books about that, which might be better, but that's the one we took. And we had a study class on Sunday morning. We had a Bible class going, but our minister and the whole church agreed to have this study class. We had about 20 25 people who came and participated in the study of that book. So that we were reflecting together, and out of that reflection we decided to go on a retreat. So we had 17 people, including all the kids and everything. I have to count everybody to get any real numbers in this. And it's nice we have Paul now, because we always represent three instead of two. Talking about numbers. So we went on a retreat, and we just had a joyful time at a big farmhouse that belonged to one of the persons that we knew, not in the church. And out of this study group came a sermon. In other words, we try to take our adult classes and pull it together and bring it into the life of the church with some sort of sermonizing. Sometimes it's very artificial and doesn't come off. You get two or three people reporting and it is really dull and uninteresting and is a flop. But the minister's wife and I talked about community, about the possibility of it in terms of some covenantal community. And then after that we had a meeting in the with about 30 people in the one of those after church sessions, meeting for sharing. And then that was the end of a year. I mean, that was a year. It didn't happen very fast. There wasn't much that had happened. So the second year, the summer came and everybody dispersed and nothing happened. So then the second year, we decided to have a meeting and invite people to come, invite the whole church, and to talk about what we might begin to do together. And I remember the discussion. I suggested, well, we might covenant to meet every Sunday night for a while, and that just blew people's minds. The thought that you would commit yourself to that much time in the light of schedules and so forth, besides church service and everything else, and all the committee meetings, and all the things you're doing, just blew their minds. So what we did was we agreed to meet four times, four Sunday nights. We have a potluck supper, and we have some group activity, and some worship, and some discussion, and we just kind of felt our way along. Then we had the 4 weeks, and at the end of that, we almost didn't make a decision. We just kind of decided, well, we'll meet again. It was very, very fragile, almost. You thought the thing might just evaporate overnight. And then we began to talk about a housing project and the possibility of getting some space where we could live together. Because for some reason or other, that seemed to be very important to me, because if we're to do and have the kind of life that's here at Holden, you got to have your people together so you can have a discussion after supper, or you can have a dance after supper, or you can have all kinds of things going on, but you got to have what I call a critical mass, and you got to be close enough to do this. I wanted to have a lot of aunts and uncles and for the kids and this, and be able to take care of an older woman. This was another thing that happened. We had another group in our church on aging about the same time, and they met after church, and one of their conclusions was that what we needed was a place where we could have intergenerational living, so that the elder citizens would live in the context of a whole way of life. So that committee had reported at the same time that something like a living unit in which the elderly and the families and the singles all lived together made some sense. That was a somewhat different group, some overlap, but not by any means half overlap. And there was one woman in the church, a delightful woman who's 82, and she went to see a retirement home, and something struck me and said, if she has to go to retirement home, this church is not doing its job. So all of this conspired to make us think about housing. Then we had a big controversy as to whether we should do our housing in our meetings or do something else. So then we'd start telling our life stories in our meeting, and we'd take two each night. We meet from 6 to 8, 8:30, usually goes to 8:30 Sunday night, and we began telling our life story and began meeting every other week. You know, this thing was just from hand to mouth. And one member started an agape meal every Tuesday night, and I think there were two people who came. You know, the idea of getting to somewhere else for me, and that was just almost impossible. Sarah and I went once. That was just a kind of another activity. We had a couple of picnics this spring and a couple of folk dances, and we began to care for each other a little. And in that process, we got together enough, although it was very, very tenuous. I remember our first meeting on the building, where we were going to bid on a building, 47th and Greenwood, which was just on the north edge of our community, right in the side of the ghetto. Our second minister said, I won't move out of a certain school district, two school districts. One gal said, well, I want to know who's in there before I move. Two or three people said, I don't like that neighborhood. It's too scary for me. I'm not going to move into it. And this one black guy said, well, I will move. Another guy said, well, I'm in seminary. I'm going to graduate next year. But the first thing in my life is this community. And so, you know, I've got to find work and so forth to be in the community. So there are really two affirmations. Sarah said, well, the only reason I'm here is because of Al. this is the life you find in a congregation when you're trying to move on anything like this. So the next, I said to Sarah afterwards, I'll resign. I feel like it. Next morning I went to the office, I made a little list, and during the day people began to come in, and by about 1 o'clock, about six of us decided, let's go ahead and bid on that building. And we did. I had a consensus. I don't know, John, how we arrived at that. We didn't have a formal meeting and get consensus, but we kind of reported it the next Sunday, and it wasn't a formal consensus, but it kind of grew out of our life and our struggles, the ups and downs. Well, things have developed much more since then, but still, it's a very, very fragile community. Someone just wrote me and said that we don't think we're going to get the option on the building, which we thought we were going to have. I thought I had that option all set. Now they're balking. And the spirits of the whole community, you know, just kind of dissolve. That's kind of what happened. Now, I gave myself 5 years to nurture this. So that's what happened in our congregation. And I think what we want to talk about now is what you might do or how you might approach it, or if you really want to move in these directions. And a part of our congregation or the community will live in, we don't have our covenant yet, but we've written it. We had several meetings on bylaws. We had about three or four people who came to those. We were working on the bylaws. We were working on a incorporation. You know, it's all just kind of, I let it grow and encourage it, and so that's our story, and it may go and it may not go. You know, fortunately, my life doesn't depend on it going, although sometimes I act as if it did. I don't depend on it for income. I suppose I depended upon it to justify my own ideas about where we ought to go. And I have a certain stake in making it succeed, too great a stake. And I tell the community, well, I got to make this meeting work tonight. Help me not.
So, when you began to form the original core, was it clear to the entire congregation that anyone that would be interested in engaging in these discussions was welcome?
I did eliminate the whole process of getting support for it. We have a budget of $5,000, and that did involve contacts with the United Church of Christ Commission on Liberation Ministry. Susan Savelle was just greatly supported and wanted, you know, came out, helped us write the proposal, and got us money, and then we went through the United Church at Home. We've gone through the disciples. They've given us $500 a year. You know, we've gone through all that process and educated other people. We constantly make announcements, and sometimes I was just amazed. One member got up recently and made announcements all on his own, just a witness to his feeling about the importance of this. We always have announcements in the bulletin and in our letter that goes out to everybody every 2 weeks, announcing it, inviting people. It's just open, and people drop off the street here and there and in different ways and come in. And we have about 15 people, our minister says, who were not active really in the church, who are working in some way or related in some way to this. But I don't know how many people we have. I think we have 7 people now who are committed. But I don't know, even about those, how long. And you know, I only know that I'm committed for 5 years. And that's about the most... It's a fragile thing. You see, I believe in it so completely that that's what I'm called to do. And there are 2 or 3 other people now who believe in it. And... With those 3 or 4 people, I'm convinced something will come. Something will come. What it will be, we're very leery about getting it too firm. But there are certain principles, the one that I enunciated yesterday, that some of us feel very strongly about, and would because we feel that is what the church is called to be. And I wrote a long paragraph in our messenger and said, in a sense, this is just what the church ought to be. It's not something else. And for the sake of the church, and you know, you have to be very cautious. You're not doing anything that's other than what you're called to be as a church. You're just trying to exemplify it and help it develop. And I don't think the church really wants to buy the building. We want the church to buy the building so it will really be involved in it. And the minister wants the church to buy the building. And you know, so that the church has that economic stake in it. And so it baptizes it as church. Our conception of it is that this is an outpost of the church. I use the image that you get in the Netherlands in some places, where you have a cathedral kind of center and you have outposts in a parish. And this is an outpost. This is the church. It is not some social service activity. It is the worshiping, faithful, covenanted community in the name of Christ that's plunked down here in the neighborhood. Now, how we relate that living community to the other people who don't want to live in, I don't know. Nobody knows. It may be that the living community will become the covenantal community and other people will kind of sink back into the church. I don't know.
As you shared your call and your vision with your parish and with this small group of people, have you shared... Could you be a little more specific in what you hope would be the spin-offs or the benefits of participating in this? Most of what I've heard you say relates, I think, to nurture, you know, basically relational support kinds of systems. And are there other things? Do you see yourself as becoming a mission group, like Crosby talks about?
Mission will be part of it. I suspect that one of the first missions will be a mission to the housing in Hyde Park, Kenwood, because it's all going condominiums, and how are you going to preserve rental units so people without big incomes can afford to live in the area, so you don't just get an upper middle class area? So, I mean, we've already considered that as part of our mission. Of course, we're learning a lot about that, and by trying to get this building, we're actually discovering what's happening in the community and how it's done and who's doing it.
Could you share a little bit more of some of the things that are going into the covenant that you're drawing on?
Well,
Some of the things you would hope that people might agree on?
I don't know whether, I did this yesterday.
Oh, I wasn't here yesterday, so don't repeat for me.
And I we can do that separately.
Sure.
Or we can do it.
Why do you suppose, or I'm wondering, this is happening in a number of places at this time, which is interesting to me. And it's happening in a lot of different ways. People who attend the meeting about Bill Deal's book might hear another kind of version of that. It's, someone used the figure of there are thousands of these communities. I don't know if that was it earlier
today.
Night.
I think he's back.
I'm here, yeah.
Yeah.
And I...
That's maybe a thousand.
Well, but I think there really
yeah, there are. Sure.
I know it, in
oh,
my area there are.
I'm sure there are thousands. Well, if you accept my interpretation, it's simply inevitable because of the thrust of our whole modern life is in such a direction that it's denied certain aspects of our being, of humanness. And so we're just saying we're not going to let ourselves be dehumanized by the culture and by the way of life. We are going to somehow resist that pressure of the whole culture. And so people all over are beginning to recapture a part of their humanness, I think. That's my interpretation.
In relationship to what you said about mentioning the Church of the Savior, I think the reason for the success of the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. is that they are structured around mission. And I think anybody that gets the idea, and I don't think Al means this because you said other things yesterday too, if you're going to just structure around being a cozy little womb group where you nurture one another, I think that's bound to failure. If in your congregation you see a need for mission and gather around you people that want to be structured for that particular mission, then I think they fly. The Church of the Savior insists that you have at least two other people, it's like going on a hike at Holden, three people at least to form a mission group. Then you get the blessing of the congregation at large. And then they grow 10 to 12 people and they nurture one another, but it's through study of the word and through their ministry. So the mission groups range anything from a coffee shop to housing to a university to emptying our orphanage in D.C. They've been very successful, and I think a lot of it is that they are always focused outward. But, well, one of her books, Elizabeth O'Connor's, is Journey Inward, Journey Outward. You know, they've both got to be there. But I think it's really important. Maybe it's putting the chicken before the egg or whatever. But I think mission and structure for ministry has to be there.
The chicken does come before the egg. I think it's cart before the horse.
Chicken before the egg.
Oh, I was just trying to ponder that.
You wonder how the first chicken.
Al, I'm from a small rural community in South Dakota, and we don't have the resources and probably the people, and everybody's related. And you seem to be talking to the larger city community. Sometime this morning, could you say something about that, or ideas that maybe we can do?
I'd like to speak to that at least briefly. The last 4 years have not been in an urban community like we described yesterday. You weren't here yesterday.
Yes.
Oh, you were? Okay. But have been in the mountains of West Virginia, where everybody is related. There are only three families in the section of the phone book that has the last names that begin with P, Puffenbarger, Probst, and Pitzenbarger. And they're related. One of the things that we really tried to do in those 4 years is to affirm those parts of their lifestyle for which they feel inferior and backward compared to the rest of the nation. And many of the things that are part of the culture of those mountains are in fact now in a in a groovy way called alternative lifestyles, simplicity of life, and expensively manufactured, even in the way of clothing and the farm machinery now is called simplicity. You know, the machine is called that. And so what we did partially was to, Don West has an Appalachian Folklife Center at Pipestem, West Virginia. And what he really does is try to get young people from the mountains to affirm their family, their heritage. The dulcimer is beautiful music. It's different, but it's beautiful music. So that part of the thing in the rural is to say the barn raising and only one of you having a post hole digger instead of four and you borrowing that one, you don't have to go to a training weekend to find out some things about living communally and to really affirm those and to maximize those and to let the congregation have some of the things that they have naturally but don't think of congregationally. I'll be glad to talk about a couple of these things. But I don't think it's a disadvantage to be starting with a rural community in the United States today. I think that's a great advantage. Now, maybe the congregation has gotten a lifestyle that does not have some of these things I've been talking about as part of it, especially interrelationships or, in last night's language, maybe the hold and hug is a long way off in a kind of formal worship. Maybe they can't even argue at church council the way they argue naturally in the town and on the farm, and so it seems to me those are the dimensions, but not that there's a disadvantage to starting with a rural community. Does that speak to it at all?
Isn't there another thing, though, with either the rural community or churches where that aren't connected close to universities, that don't have a lot of professional people that have a lot of time, those that do? I mean, it's a question both of economics and of time for some people. In our community, we have a lot of university people, a lot of seminary students, lots of ministers from different congregations. And what we're struggling with is how do we incorporate people who are up and on the train at 7 in the morning and get home at 6:30 or 7 at night and have three or four kids. It seems to me that if you really talk about community, you also have to talk about changing the way we make money. Some of us make money, and also the way in which we raise our families in terms of nuclear families. And this is something that we're struggling with right now. Otherwise, in some ways, some of us are feeling it is kind of elitist for those people who have the time. And I teach 6 hours a week, so I have the time.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that we're going on this fall retreat this year to really try to.
Somebody has to have the time, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, I have the time since I'm retired. And but other people, this one gal now said, I'm going to finish seminary in 2 years. Instead, 1 year. So that she can give her time, and I think you've got to get people to withdraw from the rat race. That's one of my purposes, is to give them the freedom and a style of life which isn't so demanding financially, and the hope that somehow you can educate your kids with what is needed without sending them to expensive colleges. I mean, the whole way, I think, has to shift myself. So the people are not driven into their roles and got a kind of freedom. I think actually, I don't know whether Joy is here, but she's in the campus church in Minneapolis, and they have 80 people in their fish industries. They have their own way of getting an income so people can fit into a way of earning a living, which is not. They didn't earn much money in the beginning in those industries, but they didn't need to because all of them were in the same situation with the same kind of sense of what was important and what wasn't.
Another approach is to have some people working in others, like Reba Place.
Right.
That takes a change.
Of course, they just throw all their income into the pot, and
right.
that... I'm thinking now, and when I raise this, sometimes people I say, well, let's put 5% beyond what we put in the church in a pot. I don't know what you did in the community of Christ. Let's put something in and begin to decide what to do with the money. So we begin to think collectively about how to use resources for things that are important, not just for ourselves, but for the community and for life. You could support one or two people, depending on how large you were. You might support a lot of people. But the campus church supports a lot of its ministry through its industry.
Yeah. What do you mean by educate the children as well as is needed? I guess that's until you get a viable alternative to expensive colleges, it's kind of hard because education is a dangerous thing to phase out.
It might be or it might not. You know that the people who don't get the education get as much money, you know, as people who do, so
it isn't
a question of money. Most of the, you know, a lot of the roles, I'm getting very anti-professional in terms of a lot of things. You ought to be able to learn to do a lot of the things that are cost you a lot of money and so forth in a community and have that kind of wisdom in your community, and only have to depend on the specialists and highly trained people. The question is, why not let some of the other people do that and you not do that? I mean, it's a decision. I think it's a great decision. What are you going to do with your existence today? I don't know. 99% of the roles that I know about, I couldn't fill. I simply couldn't fill. And so I think that's one of the greatest issues we face is, what's a meaningful existence call us to do? I think it does not call us, in my judgment, to do anything or not to do anything, absolutely, but it calls into judgment everything that is being done in the way of the important roles in our society because of what that way supports in what I call a very demonic way of being.
I'm not sure that's quite on the track of what I was getting at, but a danger with the community seems to me, danger is a funny word, but is getting provincial, or people who go away to school, who can travel abroad and study, because that adds tremendous amount to your life, especially if you can do it when you're young.
Paul Douglas said there's more culture in a can of tomatoes than in all the travel that anybody, if you learn about a can of tomatoes. No, I think travel is an escape from meaninglessness, mostly.
Okay, I really strongly disagree.
Well, now, if you went to a country and lived for a year or two, that's one thing, and participated in
that. I did that in school.
Participated in their life. But if you're just traveling around, you know, taking pictures of what you would have seen if you hadn't taken the pictures and looking at them when you get home. I'm caricaturing a lot, but as you can tell, I have some very deep feelings.
Is it fair for parents, like, with a college education to decide that their child doesn't need it anymore?
Why not? No, if the child wants a college education and he decides when he gets to be 18, you can get a college education. You can go in debt. I know hundreds of kids who are taking out government loans and going in great debt. I question about whether it's wise or not, but you can do it, right? If that's the value system that you buy into. Well, I think these are all issues. I don't mean to settle them at all. I'm just giving you a perspective. It's only my perspective. It isn't shared by most of the people in my community. When I talk like this, they say, you've made it. You can say all that stuff. So.
Another issue that I don't know, in terms of just problems, is this whole notion of individual rights that we have so ingrained in us from our American heritage, and somehow we have these inalienable rights. A lot of us have tried to look in the Bible to see where we're guaranteed those, and we have a hard time finding the passages, but it's become part of our religion. So then when one starts talking about community and submitting yourself to the people in the community, the consensus, that gets very, very difficult for people to think about. And the problem becomes for us, maybe it was raised up above, was when does consensus become conformity, a kind that may be unhealthy? And we're having, I'm sure every community has these kind of growing pains and goes through these cycles. But I think that's something else when people start thinking developing communities, they have to start rethinking the whole notion of individual rights as opposed to a community that makes decisions.
That's what you found in your community, yeah, to be a very difficult thing.
It is, especially when you've got all these people who are, well, professors are really kind of entrepreneurs, very individualistic, and ministers even more so. Try to tell a minister something. And, so you get all these people who come out and are very that way, plus some of the professionals in the community that are that way, and then I think it really takes a more than a minor adjustment to make the community work. For people to evoke gifts, and perhaps sometimes someone thinks their gift is something or other and everyone sees it to be something entirely different. And we go through this gift evoking process. We have a group that tries to draw out the gifts. And, people are afraid to give that group power. You know, I don't know. There's nothing settled in what I'm saying. I'm just saying that's the problem.
And the joyful community, they really have to break that individualistic,
I think so, orientation.
Orientation before the person can be accepted into it. And they have systematic ways of doing it. I just shudder when I read those sections in there. Anybody else have any experience about trying something like this?
Yeah, I was involved in a group this last year that, listening to you, felt just about exactly, incredibly parallel, even to talking about buying a place. And what we discovered, the group just started as a group that had, of us who without knowing, never having heard of covenant or community, decided to meet once a week and to commit ourselves to that above other considerations. To pray for a Bible study group which was foundering. And we discovered halfway through the year and after having many emotionally draining experiences between us and fights and having to get to know each other before we could function as an intercessory group of any effect, we discovered that we were being forced into a position where if we wanted to get any deeper, we would have to commit ourselves to each other. We found ourselves just to the point where you were so vulnerable that you couldn't tell your life story in any more detail until you knew for sure that you weren't going to be attacked with what you were saying. And we started, reading about the early church and the fights that they had about things, and we discovered that the only way that you can possibly live in a really close relationship with someone is within some kind of a covenant agreement where you are placing yourselves in submission to each other and to God, where you have this kind of a loving community situation. Ours quit when the summer came, and I doubt if we will get back together again as that group. But it was an interesting experience to find that we couldn't go any deeper until we committed ourselves to each other.
I guess I'd like some assessment for myself. How many of you are in parishes where you feel that you have a sense of community already? That you're... Pardon?
I feel like I belong to the congregation where I am, and I feel at home there and at peace there. But I can't say that I could go around and name all the people there. Uh-huh. It's just my own feeling within that congregation. Mm-hmm. And that has just come about by participating in things and just being a part of the central function of it sometimes. Right now I'm not, and I'm waiting. I was so delighted when you said something about yesterday about waiting for the evoking of the gift. because that's another story, but I feel a part of it. Now, I don't know how it ever came about, really, but I feel that they're my family. And that's a big congregation. I think there's 600 or 700 members.
Do some of you today, on the basis of what it was advertised to be or the discussion yesterday, do you see possibilities within an existing congregation that you are part of, that there could be some expressions of a covenant group and it would not be divisive? I mean, are you...
We're working on, in my congregation, a group. It was open to everybody to come, but a group of about 20 people have been meeting twice every other Sunday night in someone's home for study and sharing of our, particularly we're looking at what we do between Monday and Friday,
mm-hmm.
what our ministry is in the world, and we always have Eucharistic feast at the end of the evening. Our group is based on one of Bill Deal's models. That is the focus of our ministry in the world. But I think that we've taken as our mission or for that group within the congregation. We're very interested in the worship renewal of the congregation. So our focus is kind of on the larger congregation. And people move in and out of the group. We're at the point now where I think some deeper commitments, such as you described, have to be made. Our group, I would describe, as very, very cautious. When people share things about themselves, it's with a great deal of self-protection, and it's appropriate that it should be that way at this point because we haven't made any kind of deeper commitment to one another. I feel that the people in that, the group has attended intended to attract those of us who have had life experiences where we very much needed at a point or points in our life, we needed this kind of a group. We lived through that. We came out the other side and survived. And somehow that made us appreciate the need for that kind of group. But we've also built up defenses that make it very difficult for us to move beyond where we are.
Yes, Carl?
I don't have any background or observation for what you reach into this, except one thing. I've observed the Mennonites and the Hutterites over the years, and the Hutterites live together like this under severe discipline, you know, from the top to the bottom. And the Mennonites have the community, a lot of separation and everything. The Mennonites have been far more, and by my observation, has been far more generous in the outreach than the Israelites. The Israelites buy more land than the Mennonites send a boxcar a week to the just a thought. So there's a danger there, I think, of being selfish, no matter what the group is.
They seem to be more what Niebuhr would call Christ against culture. So culture, they've withdrawn for the sake of faithfulness, is over against withdrawing for the sake of penetrating and serving the culture.
Yes, they're outward and open to a point. And when it comes to that, after the taxes are paid, they're pretty close. That was a danger. I can see that might be a danger. That's a large group, though, compared to what you're...
Seems like the Catholic Church in some of their communities are going through a reverse process almost. Here is some of the sisters who who grew up in a very close community and are now attempting to live in smaller groups outside, it seems that there's some lessons to be learned.
But I tell them, if their closed community had been inclusive, they could take their closed communities and just begin to include all kinds of people within them instead of going out. Because they're fragmenting themselves. They live in a convent and then they go out all over the town. And it's kind of a fragmentation.
I guess I still feel that there are some real possibilities for renewal in what we've been talking about. So let me just say that briefly, because I see we're getting close on time. I think if there were a congregation of 400 or 500 or 600 people, that my image of that is you really have many congregations who have affiliated together of the size I think of as a congregation, meaning knowing one another by name and what have you, and you have a cathedral to which you come, and I think that ought to continue. I mean, I think there is some real advantage to a group that gathers in a building large enough with an organ and what have you, and when you come there, the congregation as such of 600 certainly can exist. But without being divisive within that congregation, I think there can be groups, I think it's an Al Pitcher phrase, who attend to particular focus on behalf of everybody, and not everybody can attend to that. In fact, not everybody's inclined the same way in a reaction to a particular need or to a particular ministry in that neighborhood. So rather than the church council viewing at the end of each year what the church's program will be for the next year, you're going to get the least common denominator and the least controversial stuff that comes and gets funded and passed, and I don't think it's going to be very lively. But if there were some groups that are very much part of that, but are involved in things on behalf of everybody, and I want to hear about it, but I can't be in that. I've got my thing. I think that's a really healthy, even on the interaction of the people in that, that can be a healthy thing. And I know there are some examples of it, but I don't think we've maximized that. I think we've been afraid of that diversity. I think an institution is afraid of not having control over it, so it doesn't let it happen. I think we can be much freer than we've been. I mean, that...
You're really suggesting the kind of mission groups that the Church of the Savior...
Yeah, very much like mission groups.
And there's all kinds of literature on that if they were interested. Yeah. It's just fascinating.
So if that plants a seed, I think that the individual groups probably need some guidelines. I think you find that you have to have enough of a shared faith. That doesn't mean you agree on everything, but you agree to have the same question, namely, what is faithfulness to Jesus Christ, or something that you don't spend all your time on a couple things to hold you together. That you have some way that you celebrate that symbolize that, some form of worship or liturgy or something, or else your worship is in that larger group, and some action outside yourself that kind of gives you your focus or something. I mean, there are many people who've talked about the guidelines of what makes a healthy group, but are you...
May I just ask one question? Is this philosophy that you are giving us being taught in the seminaries? And I tell you the reason I ask it, we come from a congregation where we couldn't even have a woman's committee meeting without pastor sitting there and approving what we said. And you know, that's the exact opposite. And we have a wealthy, intellectual, controlled congregation where they can't even conceive that, say, some of us live in an area that is not wealthy, even though that's part of the congregation, that we don't all come by car and cannot all come by car, and the bus system won't even get you there, and that our church council is made up of people who are executives in business controlling a business on this space we function. So I wonder if in the seminaries any of this is filtering through. We have a different situation now. We do no longer have a pastor who comes to everything and tells us what we have to do as a committee.
I think that there were many models like you just described, and I think in the old German tradition, the Herr Pastor really did do that. The word parson comes from the person, and what that meant was the only person educated in most situations, the only person could read and write. In other words, that there is a history to that. I think the seminary training and education and even modeling for a congregation is very different today. Yes, I sure do.
Could I ask you again the name of that church you referred to, that where you could study the Church of what did you call
the
it?
The Church of the Savior, Washington, D.C. Most of the writing about it has been done by Elizabeth O'Connor. The first book is Call to Commitment, Harper and Row. That's way back, 63, something like that. The church has been there since right after the Second World War. Inward Journey, Outward Journey. Journey Inward, Journey Outward, all right. I think those are the two that cover the history of the Church of the Savior in the most complete way. She has a lot of other books, Our Many Selves and The Eighth Day of Creation.
The Eighth Day of Creation is in the bookstore, and it's on invoking gifts. That's a good book.
Eighth Day of Creation?
Eighth Day.
We could actually get up the kind of bibliography if people are interested in that thing. If you want to, I thought about that. If you want to sign it, and somebody here, or I, or somebody will,
One thing I'm wondering, like Mennonites and Hutterites, they do go through the generations. What I guess I'm saying is, how do these communities, Church of the Savior, is it experienced in the second generation in the community? You know, how does the community tend to split up after the first generation has kind of moved on, not moved on, but has gotten older, and the younger people are coming up. Is the interest sustained in the community? Does it?
Most of the ones we've talked about do not have history enough for me to tell you whether they do or not. Church of the Savior is now, 23 years old, something like that. Certainly has second generation people, but I guess there's more of a commitment to ad hocism than there is to an institution. When your religious faith is something alive and spontaneous, for it to be something other than a wish dream, you put it in a form. It becomes a religion. And religion is always the potential murderer of faith, because religion has to do two things. It has to make it memorable and manageable. It has to put it in some form of catechism so it can be taught, and in some structure so that it can be managed. And as soon as you've done that, you have squashed that which has to be spontaneous and like the wind, where you don't know where it came from or where it's going, but you know it hits you. A church, a religion can't tolerate something that you don't know where it came from or where it's going, and only that it might hit you. So it makes a place where that happens and builds an altar and all those things. But if you want it to always be spontaneous, it tends to be a wish dream. So it takes form. It takes form in seven people who want to buy a building and what have you. Finally, then, the difference is going to come between whether or not you really are existing to maintain the institution. Then you're going to have not only memorable but eternal, or whether you're willing for the thing to take shape around an issue that might be gone in 4 years, and you find a new way in which you cluster yourself and have only enough structure to enable an idea to stay alive. If you can imagine that a church, that some people's idea of church is a group that holds enough parties so that they keep touch with one another, that's not a bad, it's not very good theological language, but that's not a bad idea of what it was meant to be the called out and to touch base and have enough structure only that the next party gets planned. Before you go, make sure when you're going to meet again. And we're so far from that. We spend all of our time maintaining that machinery, and that was not the whole point of the thing. So Most of the groups I've referred to do not worry about second generations keeping the thing going. And that blows some people's minds, and it's a breath of fresh air for others. So.
And I think it's important to remember, if your covenant group folds, I mean, if you're only going to be with it for 5 years, let's say you've got it together, and after 5 years it's no longer valid, I don't think you look at that as failure. Because for the time that you were in it, if it's even 5 weeks where you shared something with somebody else and covenanted with someone, I think it's valid. I guess I'm just agreeing with you.
There's another question for education of young children in the community. That's something that people are trying to struggle with, to tell and push about.
Yeah.
A lot of the communities that at least we've looked at do not have a lot of children present.
Yeah.
Very, very few children present. And so the question of how one integrates the family into these communities and educates children is, I still think, very open for thought.
I have some trouble with the word covenant itself.
All right.
When it's applied to this kind of compacting together or whatever. And maybe that's just because I'm less of a voluntaristic sort of Christian, I guess, who is always intentional about what I do and who I associate with and who I find community with. And I expect this may be more the case with some of us, I don't know, that we do find community within the various groups of the church that we're part of, as well as outside the church. I often feel a much deeper sense of community and commitment to working out a particular purpose with a bunch of parents in our daycare center than I do with a good many of the people in our own congregation. There are just more natural affinities between us, more shared concerns. And while there isn't a lot of covenanting together to achieve certain things, those concerns get worked upon in real practical ways, and there's outreach effort that goes on there also. I don't know, I may be too picky about this, but isn't it a kind of Calvinistic intrusion into the way most of us go about living our lives to think that we have to be intentionally covenantal in our coming together around these kinds of issues? It almost seems like Al is saying that, he's almost being a little apologetic, that we really haven't gotten to the covenant yet. But I think
we have a living covenant, not a written covenant. We have, you know, we are
right.
Committed. I mean, it's clear, which is in some ways more important than the written, because the written is only for the sake of the living. And one of our members always says, well, you know, you start out your covenant with a notion that you don't initiate it, that God has made a covenant with you, with the people in which you participate, and that's the first statement you make and the first thing you think about, so it gets a little bit away from this voluntaristic.
Well, that's finally what I wanted to get at, that
I
think the biblical covenant is a whole different sort of thing than the way we use covenant and the way the Puritans use the word covenant. And I think we're in danger of drawing on a strain that is not of our own tradition, that we don't thoroughly understand, and that may just be a catchword.
I do believe you have to be somewhat intentional about it, or you'll be carried along by the culture, which in my view is very destructive and fragmenting, and there's no way to oppose it except by being somewhat intentional. If you follow your own inclinations generally, you'll be swept along by it. And for example, in our community, I suggested at a very early stage that we bring our important decisions to the community. Nobody's done it. Nobody is used to doing it. For a family to decide to move out of the community because a husband needs a job somewhere and just leave all those relations, not even come to the community and talk about it. And I mean, unless you really begin to say, well, it does make some difference to all of us. when a family leaves. And therefore, we ought to almost know about it as soon as they begin to think about leaving and talk about it. It's got to be somewhat intentional, I think.
That's my problem, too, that I think a lot of the search for community is as a substitute for the extended family. That
granted,
that we all miss in some way.
Absolutely true. I think it's true.
And what makes the extended family work is just the very givenness of it. It's not necessarily that it's patriarchal or matriarchal, but it's given. It's a group of people that you're given to beyond any intentions that you have.
And in theory, we are given our community by our call to respond to what God has given us in a church. In theory, we are given that community, but we don't have it in most churches. Not in my experience. We just don't have it. And all I can talk about in mine, I was a part of a fairly large church for 20 years, and nobody in the church ever knew or cared what I thought about anything I thought. All external, go to meetings, you minister stuff, you do all kinds of stuff. But begin to relate to your being and be responsible for each other's being. It wasn't there as far as my experience was. Now maybe your experience is different. So you say you get it in the daycare center where people begin to care for the whole, you know, the kids and the families involved and see the interrelationship. That'd be a perfect place in a way for the church should have its daycare center in my position, and because we ought to be related to whole persons in a whole way. Everything ought to somehow funnel through that.
But I get it in other places too. I guess it's not just one kind of community that provides for those
needs. Sure, I get it in 20 places. I like to bring all those 20 more into one. I folk dance with one group. I never see those people. The meaning of my folk dancing can't enhance in any way my relation to them in the church as a worshiping group or to their kids, because I never see their kids. The whole theory involved here about what's destructive about the way we fragment all of our being.
Now, I think you've got some valid points. And the word covenant, I've heard legal people talking about the difference between covenant and contract. And I'm not sure it's the best word. I think one of the ways it is used is instead of a constitution, which clearly says a kind of institutional approach with a very important thing as who's a member, who's not a member. Covenant is a more personal thing. Instead of constitution, which shapes it, covenant is a way in which we describe what we have. I mean, that was one of the reasons we chose covenant instead of constitution. One of the ideas was that we would decide, instead of assuming once a member, always a member, unless they kick me out, we would renew that regularly. Those were really the only two things we meant by it. Those were really the only two alternatives to the way other congregations form themselves and live their life. So we in the community of Christ tried to find a word for a difference between constitution and a different understanding of membership, which was, those were the two primary things we were looking at.
But the substance of your life, as I've read that story and talked to Larry, is quite different in terms of your sense of responsibility together for your total life as a group of people. Even though you don't say it all in the covenant, it's certainly there in the substance, I felt. That isn't different from what a church, in my notion,
should be. Yeah, right. That's
but in fact, it's different. Therefore, all you're doing is calling the church to be itself. That's all I'm interested in doing, is calling the church to be faithful.
In John Howard Yoder's words here, we already, as Lutherans, have come from what Lutheranism was, and that state church, where it would have been against the law not to baptize our children, to almost a covenant or a free church. The Lutheran Church in the United States is not one of the historic old typologies of free and state. We're kind of a mixture of a tradition of Lutheranism, but with voluntary membership to a certain extent, because we weren't all baptized as infants, or at least our parents weren't arrested if they didn't do it. So it gets kind of mixed up as to what we are in the way of congregational form.
But I think we lose a lot too if we simply assimilate to the mainline American evangelical form of voluntarism, which is based, whose theological center is based on covenant to a large extent.
Well, I think it's probably
thank you for your interest.